This is a lecture on John Gaventa's book, Power and Powerlessness, Quiescence and Rebellion in an Appalachian Valley. We read. So I just want to sort of walk you through this because I find this a fascinating study. Of course, it is a very specific and focused study on the Cumberland Gap and particularly the town of Middleboro in Tennessee. But its significance is that what happens in that area is generalizable indefinitely. So why I think this is such a fascinating thing is that it lets us see how power is implemented, how the implementing of power extends from raw acquisition of land and territory, oftentimes on the basis of violence, although that's not exactly what happens in this particular situation. From the acquisition of land and resources to the building of infrastructure to the structuring of social inequalities to takeover and dominance within the political forum all the way up to the dissemination, the successful dissemination of ideological components which integrate the population in this area into the overall schemes of those who have taken control over it. It lets us see that whole process from beginning to end just in this one little chapter. I think it's also interesting. I mean, this allows you to see how westward expansion is working, how post-Civil War dominance by northern industrial capital and really capital from the northeast of the United States, from New England, and from England itself, how that capital took over territories which it had previously not accessed, and then how it changed the life, the pattern of life, the physical environment, the pattern of labor of individuals, but then ultimately also the way they thought. So we do get a chance here to look at how values are instilled or how they are altered in such a fashion as to make people acquiescent. That's the point of this study. How do you produce a felt consensus in a situation which could be otherwise? In a situation where, for example, a bunch of miners, here we're talking about coal miners, could end up developing class consciousness and building unions, which happened within 40 miles of this particular town. They could have developed an ideology which was in opposition to the ideology favored by absentee capital. They could have done it, but they didn't. Power worked successfully in this region to produce the ideology, to produce the values and the patterns of thought most conducive to its continuation. So much so that even when 6 years into this boom, the company totally collapses and the town collapses, they are able to come back under a corporate ruse as a different company and reassert their power for decades into the future. So we get to see how power has a physical foothold, has to have a physical foothold, but then extends all the way through to the way that people think. This means, for one thing, it means we have another answer to the question, what happened to democracy and freedom in the United States? Now, I imagine a whole lot of you will be a little bit slow to sympathize with a bunch of Tennessee, what's the word, hillbilly, I suppose would be the most accurate one, you know, sort of isolationist, separatist, low-income Tennessee types. Although if you look closely, you'll see that the sort of racism that you would expect in this region doesn't actually exist. At least it doesn't exist uniformly. There is solidarity between white workers and black workers, for example, on multiple occasions in this region. But if you can take this instance as one where early American values about independence and freedom and so on were really at home, then you can view this transition as being of interest from the ideological point of view, because what happens is that the values that used to be in place about independence and freedom and separation and the wish just to live without much change in a beautiful place without too much labor, you know, maybe getting a little bit of moonshine in the evening, a non-success oriented culture, a non-ambitious, a non-capitalist culture, here gets completely overwritten by a new set of values. So you want to know what happened to the values in the U.S., you got to look at things like this process of industrialization of a Tennessee Valley. All these like farm folks get turned into coal miners. And coal miners have some of the worst lives you can imagine, by the way. The last thing is that there's a model going on in Gaventa that I think is worth pointing out. And that is that Gaventa treats the incursion of Northeast American and then English capital into these Tennessee valleys as colonization. So this is interesting, right? Because the people who were there were already colonists. You know, they got this land however far back. Well, not that far back at this point. They got this land by taking it from Native American folk. They're colonizers. And yet then they settle down into this pattern of life, which to them seems desirable and reasonable. And I'll tell you, to me too, actually. And then they in turn get colonized. And there's an insistence in the Gaventa text of saying this over and over, that they are colonized. They are effectively colonized, meaning that their territory is taken over, their resources and markets are integrated into a larger scale system, their labor is incorporated into that system, so they are forced to work in ways that they previously would never have wanted to work. And then their very manner of thinking is seized control of too. And the way that they think and the way that they value and what they think is important and the pattern of life that they esteem is changed too. So how does this happen? That's the interest of this story. So it's interesting because we have an instance of the historical expansion of the industrial North and its development of, in this case, I guess the Middle South or something. But it's also interesting because as a model of power and how this model of power works, it is applicable in any number of circumstances. It so happens that this guy, John Gaventa, who I think is really cool and who runs a labor center somewhere, if I remember correctly, he studied with an older guy named Stephen Lukes, who is well known for having written this book called A Radical View of Power. So if you're interested in trying to understand how power works, these are good books to read. I actually find Gaventa more readable than Lukes and more interesting to read because it's so applied. But what he takes from Stephen Lukes is that, according to Lukes, you know, power operates on three dimensions. Really, you have to add a fourth. The one that we'd have to add is, well, there is land acquisition. There's territorial expansion and takeover. But that's a phenomenon that Lukes takes for granted. And what he wants to understand is, how is hegemony built? How is control of a territory established? And especially, how does it work on the minds of those who are controlled? So in Lukes' book, he takes three different models, which he derives mostly from political science and then from like critical theory, which is 20th century neo-Marxist, neo-Freudian philosophical writing. Different people say that power works in different ways, but really they're all right, and we need to understand how power works in these multiple dimensions. So he's considering, like, for example, to begin with, political power. One way in which power in a region works is by preventing certain individuals from taking part in decision-making. So this is the nature of the Jim Crow South. It's also the nature of racial segregation in the North in the 1700s and 1800s. There were not Jim Crow laws on the books in, say, Massachusetts in 1800, but there was a de facto prevention of black folks from voting. So they were just prevented basically by the threat of violence. In the South, post-Civil War, very quickly, we get laws which either directly or indirectly prevent black people from voting. So one clear way in which power can be maintained by one class is to keep other classes from having any role at all in political decision-making. So that's the first view, or what in Lukes will become the first dimension of power. But then secondly, even if you are included in a democratic political system, there are still ways in which certain things are prevented from becoming issues. So this is the sort of thing that happens in Middleborough, in the mines of the Cumberland Gap, which Gaventa discusses. He's like, okay, so they did set up, and these are largely imported from labor struggle elsewhere, they set up a set of laws that were sort of in the interests of miners. You know, for example, they set up regulations for how the mines ought to be set up in the interests of safety. They made provision for somebody to check the weighing system of the company that was running the mine and paying the workers because they tended to cheat. So these things were put in place, but then they were never implemented, and they were caused never to become issues within the judicial system. If you can control what is going to become an issue or what laws are actually going to be enforced, this is another dimension of power. And then lastly, there's the ability to shape the conceptions of the people who are powerless, the people who are dominated. If you can shape how they think, and if you can alter how they understand inequality, if you can do away with the degree to which they actually understand their own situation, well, this is sort of the pinnacle of power. And maybe this is something that's necessary in order for power, or in this case, you know, mine ownership. It's not even mine ownership. It's resource ownership and infrastructure ownership. The owners are best served in the case where they can not only take over territory, not only monopolize the political system, but ultimately influence the thinking of their own workers in their behalf. That's when power is operating most fully. Gaventa says this is what he finds. By studying this particular area, you can see this whole process unfold. Okay, so how does it start? Well, it starts in the 1880s. It starts with land acquisition. So capital from England and capital from New England are organized by a guy named Arthur, who's sort of the spearhead here and becomes a hero in the town, to move in to this particular region. Now, the region they had already sent their scouts around. They knew that this region was super coal rich. It had been avoided before because it was so hilly, and like, how are you going to get all that stuff out? And previous enterprises attempting to carry out manufacturing had failed because the ideology of the locals wasn't favorable to manufacturing. You know, they tried to offer them more money, but these people already had what they needed, and they didn't want any more money. There was really a different ideology in place. The success ideology was not in place in the Cumberland Gap in the middle of the 1800s. It had to be imposed, and it was eventually successfully imposed, although not so successfully 30 or 40 miles away. Anyway, so first they show up, and they start getting land. How do they get land? They get it every which way they possibly can. The first thing they do is that they have a strategic advantage over the locals. The owners, the capitalists here, have at least a rough idea what is the value of the minerals concealed inside these hills. And by the way, this is the territory, this is part of the world where mountaintops are now blown off, right? I mean, like the devastation in Appalachia is fairly huge. And I think urban folk looking at, you know, the middle of the country and a bunch of white poor folk tend not to empathize, but I think y'all ought to. Anyway, they cheat people. They buy stuff super cheap. But then when they can't buy stuff, then they resort to force. They resort to legal means. For example, they'll wait for somebody to die. When that somebody dies, their property passes to all their children. They acquire an interest in, or they buy the portion assigned to one of those children. The rest of the children say won't sell. They take them to court, and the court forces everybody to sell all that land at auction to the highest bidder. So this, by the way, already signifies an infiltration by large-scale capital into the legal system, right? So they're buying up all these mountains, and they're cheating people out of the mountains, and sometimes they're forcing people out of the mountains, and sometimes they're hiring vigilantes to burn down the farms of people on land that they want. They're using every means that they see necessary. And then they proceed to build up this massive infrastructure really quickly. So they build railroads and they build kilns and they build brick factories, and they keep control over a good portion, the most essential portions of this infrastructure. So they own the resources themselves, and they own the means of transporting those resources, namely the railroad. Okay, so they've taken territory. They've physically patterned that territory as conducive to a particular industry. And this, by the way, is one of the ways you can understand the prior antagonism between the American South and the American North. What the slavers would have done with Tennessee is radically different from what Northern capital wanted to do with Tennessee. They needed to actually physically pattern the space in a different way. So here they've gotten their free hand. The South is defeated. There's no more aristocratic slave-owning power in the South. So the infrastructure is in place. This allows capital to control whatever is going to happen at a somewhat higher level. So individual businesses are possible. They can be run by different individuals, but they're going to be run under the conditions set by American Association Limited, right? Then, once they've set up the territory to function for a particular industry, so it's about coal extraction. Now they're starting to structure social classes. And in the boom environment, he says, this isn't immediately obvious because there's a sheen, there's an ideological sheen going on. For the first 5 years or so, 1888 to 1883, that makes it look like, yeah, okay, so there are some radically wealthy people getting even more radically wealthy out of this situation, but all the poor folk can get rich too. So there's this illusion when the industry comes into the region that it's good for everybody. I think we see this kind of thing still today. You know, we're told that industry going into any particular region is going to be, it's going to be good for everybody. It's going to make jobs, like, you know, all this stuff is going to trickle down. Everybody's going to get rich. But at the same time that there's this perception of shared interest, what's really being established is a diversification of interest under the guidance of the final interest of American Association Limited. So classes are being set up. And the classes that are being set up correspond to ownership and control over this industry. So you have, at the very top, absentee ownership from London and the north of the United States. So once in a while, these super rich people show up and they build these elaborate hotel and I guess it's pre-golf courses, but resort sort of areas. So these super wealthy people are dropping in to vacation once in a while, including at the very beginning, you know, dukes and duchesses from England. The point is, this is now the upper class. They're not just upper class in that they are rich and local folk are poor. Their upper classness corresponds to the control of this region. They're not just nomadic upper class. They are the upper class of the Cumberland Gap at this point. Now, they appoint people to run the businesses for them. They control the capital. They are going to receive the profits, but the actual work is going to be done by a supervisory class. So now they set up supervisors and managers as local representatives of these absentee owners. And in various ways, they're sort of working with the fabric that existed there before. So they're, for example, taking people who had a decent amount of social prestige before, and they're incorporating them into their enterprise. They make them managers. So they apparently treat them with respect, but they actually integrate them into a structure where they're not at the top of the heap. And then below them, there are small entrepreneurs and merchants. So the people who can live off of the needs of the coal miners, people who can run stores, people who can manufacture small tools or import small tools that are necessary in mining, the people who run the brick factory, which is necessary for building these big furnaces and whatever, the electrical company. Okay, and then way down at the bottom, there are the workers, ditch diggers, laborers, construction people, miners. And these are people who are drawn horizontally from the farms and hollows around that territory. And so they're lifted up out of their previous agrarian lifestyle and they're pulled into an industrial lifestyle. And in many cases, this is forced because their land is taken away from them. So that's second level, I suppose we could say. Level one, take over the land. Level two, stratify socially. Construct social classes in correspondence with the division of labor of this particular industry. So now you have a hierarchy that didn't exist before. There was no subservience to a manager before. There was no subservience to foreign capital before. Now there's whole levels of subservience, and there are better and worse people in a way that there weren't previously. Then the upper class takes control of the political apparatus. So by 1888, the state legislature is already acting in the interests of the company. And this has to do with larger scale relationships between political entities and big capital. You can depend on political entities fairly systematically to favor big capital, because if they don't, there are going to be big consequences. So what did they do? They set up their own candidates. You know, the first election was the Yellow Creekers, which was the name of the town before it was renamed Middleborough. It was the Yellow Creekers versus the Foreigners. And the Foreigners brought in like a Civil War veteran, hero, experienced politicians. And by hook or by crook, they win that first election. But then they slowly, over the course of years, they integrate the people who had opposed them. The patriarch of Yellow Creek, for example, this well-respected older individual. They incorporate him into their own structure. They employ him, and then they employ him as a politician. So they get control over the political apparatus. They fill positions with the people that they choose, people who are from outside the region, people who are dependably oriented only towards money. And with control over this political apparatus, they are then in a position to determine what is going to become an issue within political debate or within judicial practice and what is not. You know, what is just going to be ignored? They're in a position to make sure that problems with safety at mines, for example, is never going to be addressed. We can just pretend it doesn't exist, and the reason that they can pretend it doesn't exist is that they control the machinery for acknowledging the existence of problems, which is the political and the governmental machinery. Now, on top of this, now there's ideological domination. First of all, there's that boom idea about common purpose and growth. And this is something that is being distributed by the company itself. Like, hey, look, everybody benefits from us being here. And then there's a sort of usage, a manipulation of the success ideology or the Protestant work ethic, which says, okay, everybody can benefit here, but you're only going to get it if you work really hard. So this is part of the proletarianization of the agrarian population in this territory. They have to be recoded so that their thinking is now oriented towards hard work. Whereas before, they were perfectly capable of hard work. They just didn't value it in itself. They thought like, okay, leisure and music and enjoying nature and shit like that is more important than money or hard work in itself. Like, why would you want to work more than you have to? That seems stupid. Now we're going to try and convince them that hard work is valuable in itself. The whole new way of life here, which rips people up off of their farms, has them living in different circumstances, ultimately more violent circumstances, certainly more exploited ones. There is no way that it can be as pleasant spending all day long in a dirty and dangerous mine. That's not as nice as spending all of your time outside enjoying the sound of the birds, right? Life is worse, but it's justified now as progress, progress in civilization. So how do they go about implementing this new ideology? Well, he gives us this nice list, which is not necessarily the only possible list, but is pretty darn interesting. He says, okay, first of all, the company engaged in the intentional distortion of information. And one of the ways in which they intentionally distorted what was possible there was through conspicuous consumption. So they have these super wealthy people from New England and from England. I mean, the richest of the rich hanging out in this luxurious hotel and on these like super luxurious grounds. And they're just enjoying themselves. They're just hanging out and drinking and eating all kinds of lovely business. And the miners, the Appalachians, they see this. And perhaps there's a confusion that happens where they're like, oh, wow, this new system, it produces that possibility. Now, I might not be able to get there immediately because apparently I have to work hard. But if I work hard, I'm going to get closer to that. And of course, they don't get there. Nobody gets there. None of the local Appalachians becomes a globe-trotting playboy. It doesn't happen. But there's an illusion that it's going to happen. And what happens instead is a sort of cheap imitation knockoff of conspicuous consumption at the level of the town. So, like, you know, lots of drinking and lots of, maybe you get to go to a restaurant or whatever. Secondly, there is an intentional and systematic glorification of the new system and culture and degradation of the old one. Everything that's old is systematically derided. How is this possible? It's possible because the company is controlling the distribution of ideas by controlling newspapers, but also by achieving hegemony, controlling the other ideological institutions like the schools and the churches. They're controlling the government. They're bringing preachers in who are trying to, quote unquote, civilize the youth. So this attack on the old culture is happening on all these different levels, and it's being justified as progress, and it's being categorized as civilization. And a part of this is to look at the old culture and call it backwards as hell. Now, of course, remember, Gaventa is thinking that this process is parallel. It basically just is another version of the process of colonization that was happening by the centers of capital over the entirety of the earth at this point in history. So the same thing, of course, is happening in Africa. How do Europeans understand Africa? They understand Africa as backwards, primitive, silly, dirty, ignorant. All the same things are going to be true about Appalachia. And in fact, I would argue, part of the reason that so many of you have negative stereotypes about Appalachia is the result of this kind of ideological work. You know, we're supposed to understand non-industrial, non-capitalist-friendly forms of life as being backwards and stupid and yokel and inbred and all the rest. I would watch out for that. You know, like, clearly we need to look out for prejudices against, you know, Native Americans as savages. That's an easy one. You know, we know that's evil. But, like, watch out for your thoughts about poor white folk, too. Those are equally manufactured as a part of the expansion of the same system. So everything that was a part of the previous culture that can be pointed at and mocked will be pointed at and mocked. So, oh, they're all like just a bunch of drunks. They love moonshine. They're all wild. They're all ugly. So all those stereotypes about Appalachian folk as being like really ugly, that's being propagated here. It's not true, by the way, of course, in case I have to tell you, that they're idle, that they're lazy, that they only eat bad food. You know, and all this stuff is false, really. And then at the same time that the old culture is run down, the new culture is praised. These rich folk coming in, they know how to enjoy nature. They know what's really good, socially speaking. They know what's really healthy. And then it goes even further than this. And this is the same sort of stuff that happens in the takeover of Africa or of Latin America. It happens in the United States itself, even once the United States is nominally an autonomous nation. This does not prevent capital coming in to a region, taking over the culture there, etc. And the takeover here involves giving everything new names, almost everything. So everything gets names from outside. They get English names. Yellow Creek becomes Middleborough. All the streets, the schools, the landmarks are being given new names with reference in large part to English culture, stuff that came completely from outside this long isolated, 100-year isolated Appalachian culture. So everything good comes to be associated with the outside, and everything that has connection to the history of the place comes to be seen as bad. Okay, so what is the overall result of this? You know, including the capacity to persuade people within church, to take over ministers, to get ministers to do your work for you, to get teachers to talk about what's civilized and what's backwards, through the utilization of what will eventually come in this class to call ideological state apparatuses. What's the outcome? The production of a consensus, a felt consensus that shapes the wants and values of the population. So much so that the middle classes praise the American Association Limited and Mr. Arthur in particular, but even the lowest classes accept that this is progress, accept that this is what has to happen, accept that this is good. And the proof for that is that 30, 40 miles away, where very similar conditions existed and where big industry, Northern and English capital, came in and developed railroad lines and bought up land and started large-scale mining underway, in other places, it didn't work as well. They were not as successful in persuading the general population about the goodness of civilization and that this is progress and all that stuff. And in those cases, there were large-scale unionization campaigns. And the miners, their ideology, their way of thinking, their values came to oppose the values of the upper class and the managerial class. That's a totally possible outcome. In Middleborough, it doesn't happen, which makes Middleborough an interesting study of like what happens when power operates successfully. What is it that happens? It controls thought. It controls values. It controls what you're supposed to think is good, what you're supposed to think is acceptable, what you're supposed to think is possible. In the case where power really succeeds, you think as they need you to think. Now, thinking as they need you to think includes buying the success story. It includes buying not the old, but the newer versions of the ideas of individualism and freedom. That is, individualism is what happens by first submitting to a large-scale capitalistic order. Freedom is the freedom of business people to do as they like. Success is what happens when you successfully integrate yourself with that system. They take over your values.